Welcome to the New Books Network.
I'm Chris Holmes, and this is Burned by Books. Here you'll find interviews with writers you already love, like Jennifer Egan and Rebecca Mackay, mixed in with up-and-coming voices like Alexandra Kleeman and Rahman Alam. You'll find us wherever you listen to podcasts, but check out previous episodes at burnedbybooks.com. And on Instagram and Twitter at Burned by Books. Let's start the show. Nell Freudenberger's newest novel, The Limits, splits its time between New York City during the early COVID outbreak and a small island off the coast of Tahiti, where a climate scientist has a front row seat to the environmental degradation of the planet's ocean and animal life. Broaching that geographic distance is Pia, daughter of Natalie, the scientist, and Stephen, a doctor overwhelmed by his impossible job tending to patients struck down with COVID. Her parents divorced and separated by oceans, Pia will leave the seemingly idyllic island to take up hybrid schooling in the city, but she brings with her a powerful secret that asks her to take part in a possible act of great violence and destruction. With the arrival of Pia, smart and headstrong, angry and anxious, Stephen's new wife, Kate, will have to balance her unmanageable work as a teacher with remote students and her fears about step-parenting such an unreachable and at times unruly new daughter. When Kate's class has a rare outdoor meeting which Pia attends, a student named Athena will enter their lives. A young Black woman trying to navigate her senior year while caring for Marcus, her nephew, as though he were her own child. This collision of worlds, divided by the limits of privilege and race, will have profound effects on Pia and on the lives of this transcontinental family. A novel of science and domestic drama, The Limits traces the lines that connect us to our environment, illuminating the ways in which we alter and destroy that which sustains us. Written with a beautiful attention to the natural world and to the universal search for dignity that requires more than simply empathy from each of us, The Limits stands with Nell's growing canon of novels, which are fearless in their transgression of limits. Nell Freudenberger is the author of the novels Lost and Wanted, The Newlyweds, and The Dissident, and of the short story collection Lucky Girls, which won the Penn Malamud Award and the Susan Kaufman Prize for First Fiction from the American Academy of Arts and Letters. Named one of the New Yorker's 20 under 40 in 2010, she is a recipient of a Guggenheim Fellowship, a Whiting Award, and a Cullman Fellowship from the New York Public Library. She lives in Brooklyn with her husband, daughter, and son. Welcome to Burned by Books, Nell.
Thanks so much for having me, Chris.
I am so pleased you're here, and I want to start from the back of the book, rather counterintuitively, to talk a little bit about your acknowledgement of the time that you spent on the island of Mo'orea. Is that
Mo'orea? Yeah.
Mo'orea.
Yeah.
And what that experience was like, and how the research you did there helped spawn aspects of The Limits.
Sure. I had the opportunity to go twice to Mo'orea while I was working on the book, and I'm especially grateful to Nautilus magazine, because when you are a writer and you say you need to go to Tahiti, it's an uphill climb. I've done my share of travel writing in the past, but my secret when I was younger was to go places that no one else seemed to want to go. You know, older writers and editors weren't as interested, and this one was a hard sell, and you know, just a magazine that'll take a chance on a novelist going to write about science. I went there with the idea that I wanted to write about the scientists who were studying coral on Mo'orea, which is a kind of an epicenter of coral research, because there are two research stations on the island. One of them is run by Berkeley. It's called the Gump Station. And then the other is called Creobe. And if you see in a map of Mo'orea, it's an island that has two bays on its north side. So sometimes people say it looks like a heart, but a heart with two indentations. I think that might be a tour company trying to sell honeymoon vacation.
The romance of the island.
Exactly. But the bays are so narrow and so beautiful. And the other station is the French National Lab, a collection of labs that's called CREOBE. And that I knew that that was where my imaginary scientist, Natalie, worked. And so I wanted to go see it. It's one of the most physically beautiful places I've ever been. Certainly, it must be the most beautiful science lab anywhere in the world. And it's surrounded by mountains. And then on the other side is this incredible bay called Punahou Bay. I went with the idea that I was going to write about the scientists who were working on conservation of coral. And one of the interesting things that happened was just a bit before I got there, there was all this press all over the world about a deep water coral reef that had been, quote unquote, discovered off the coast of Tahiti. Yet the reason that it had sort of escaped scientists' knowledge was because of how deep it was. And the type of coral that grows there has these kind of plate-shaped formations. If you think about coral that grows in the more shallow water, it has these, some of it has these finger-like projections. And these plates are evolved to capture as much light as possible in deeper waters. Sometimes that area that's called the mesophotic zone of the ocean, where there's less light. And scientists were really excited about this reef because it, you know, over and over again, journalists described it as pristine. It just didn't seem to have suffered some of the damage that coral in warmer water suffers. And then once I got to Moorea, I talked to people who said, I talked to Tahitians, especially one diver who was the head of a diving association who said, look, our ancestors have been diving on this reef, free diving, you know, without diving equipment for generations. And they may say that they discovered it, but we've known about it forever. And so it was this interesting tension between, you know, this really valuable science that's going on the island and also, you know, what I was learning there, which was about these indigenous conservation methods that were becoming more and more central to the way people think about conserving reefs.
Yeah, both of those things are fascinating and hopeful, both the idea of coral that grows in cooler waters and is designed to operate in less light, but also the turn to indigenous science as a much longer and more established, ironically, way of thinking about these things. And I know you're interested in indigenous sciences. And did you come upon any other evidence that they were being brought to bear on these two scientific outposts?
Well, there's tons of evidence in both. I don't want to give the idea that Western scientists on this island aren't. In many cases, they're you know, actively embracing these concepts, like the idea of brahui, which is a sort of a Western idea might be like a marine protected area that stays in one place. And sometimes those protected areas where fishing isn't allowed to preserve a reef could be, you know, right in front of a hotel. There's a little bit of hypocrisy sometimes about where these zones are placed, as opposed to a more traditional idea of Rahui. And when I am an absolute outsider on this island, and things that I learned when I was there, I learned not only from the American and French and British scientists I spoke to, but from island elders like Hanano Murphy, who's a big, who's an activist and an ambassador for Tahiti and her island. And so those are the people who told me about these methods like Rahui, which is a more flexible concept of a zone, a protected zone that can move with the seasons. That could be, it could be more of a set of regulations for when you could fish for particular species, at what stage in their life cycle. And it also has a spiritual component. And so that was some of the stuff that I was just starting to learn about. Obviously, I wasn't, you know, I've made only two trips to this island, so I'm really looking at it as an outsider.
Well, that's fascinating. To turn to the novel itself for me, the limits is about testing different kinds of limits, environmental, viral, personal, emotional, even legal. Limitation in the novel operates not simply as a barrier, but as a catalyst to attempting something new. A macro example would be the limitations of a pandemic on movement and socialization, prompting new modes and technologies for making community. And a micro one might be the limits of care for family that isn't blood family, a limit we watch Kate try to broach with Pia. Would you take us through your sense of the limit as a concept in the novel and how it became such an important thing in the book?
Yeah, I had this wonderful professor in graduate school, Brian Morton, and he told us that if we were working on stories at that time, and he said, if you've written more than half of your story and you haven't come up with the title yet, that probably indicates that there's a problem. And I don't, for whatever reason, I grasped onto that idea, and it always makes me, I always have a sense of relief when I come up with the title. So it was pretty early in the process that I knew that it was called The Limits. And I also like to take titles from very concrete, kind of furniture inside a story or a novel. And so this was really, it really started out as being about the limit that of how deep you can dive, for example, when depending on what level of certification you have, or the upper limit of warming that the planet can sustain, which we seem really likely to surpass, the limit of a function that Pia studies in her math class when she's in France. And then, of course, it becomes more abstract and emotional, you know, the limits to what people who think in two different languages can communicate, even inside a marriage. Natalie and her ex-husband, Stephen, she's a French speaker, and obviously she spoke English, but they're sort of coming at their arguments from two different languages. And then in terms of COVID, you know, how much suffering can a physician stand by and watch without being able to do anything? How long can family members remain isolated together before there's some kind of emotional explosion? So that's it. Those are things I was thinking about when I was writing the book. And then there was something else that I thought about when I was finished, just something I've been thinking about since I was, kind of first starting out as a writer. These 19th century novels that I admired had took place in societies where there were really clear social strictures in place. And, you know, a lot of the characters that I love the most, Anna Karenina or Dorothea Brooke, the drama of the novel comes from them transgressing those limits. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so I thought to myself, you know, what replaces those limits in contemporary fiction? And I didn't really have an answer. And I think in this book, I was thinking about how our limitless greed is causing the natural world to react and place limits on us, whether it's through, the devastation of a pandemic or extreme weather or the die-off of an entire ecosystem.
That's so fascinating. So the planet itself establishing some limits to counteract our voraciousness.
Sort of as a last resort, right? Mm-hmm. Given us so many chances.
And you do have this wonderful direct reference to the limit in the description of a submersible that a billionaire American took into Mariana's Trench and to look at new species and sadly observe plastic and candy wrappers at the bottom of the abyss.
That's an amazing fact. plastic bags down there as well.
I couldn't believe it, and I figured it was true. It seemed to ring so true to what we know about plastic being everywhere. But that submersible was named the limiting factor. And I wonder if you talk about that little factoid and that's so entertaining in the book.
Sure. I mean, that was a really late breaking addition to the book, because I had read about these submersibles that rich people sometimes take down to the deepest parts of the ocean. They usually have a less successful safety record than those that scientists take down. But every time a scientist goes down there, they come up almost every single time there's a deep water expedition, they identify new species. There was just an expedition off the coast of Chile where they were exploring a seamount, like an underwater mountain, that's four times the height of the tallest building on Earth. And the scientists who just, this just happened, and the scientists who just came back were talking about potentially 100 new species being identified. So I think, like, I've always had this fantasy of going down there. I think if I were a billionaire, I would be totally tempted to send myself down into Somersault, because I would love to see that ecosystem down there that depends on the organic waste. I don't know if you've ever seen marine snow, but I mean, this is a very easy thing to see on a YouTube video. It's like the detritus from animals that live in the upper zones. So when you're looking at it, it's completely dark down there, but it looks as if it's snowing. And there's a whole, you know, there's an entire ecosystem of creatures that live down there. And I think maybe just as, you know, as kids, like, who I'm sure you and I both, you know, kids who read all the time and imagine escaping into a totally unknown realm, you know, like you can in so many YA books, but you think doesn't exist on Earth. The idea that there's this zone of the ocean that's protected by the cold and by the pressure and by its depth. It's actually been protected from human activity. And scientists compare it to an Amazon rainforest that has never been touched, right? So it's almost like, it's like this, it's this sort of magical other realm where we might have a chance to start over and do things right. And that's why the threat of deep sea mining, which is a, you know, a part of the plot of the book, is so was so frightening to me, is why it was part of the book, because it seems like we're about to make the same mistake in the deep ocean that we've made everywhere else.
Yeah, and if we reach the very depths and the last untarnished areas of the planet and just mine them away, then that, even that fantasy then disappears. I don't know, did you ever see the show Stranger Things?
You know, I've seen the first episode and I really liked it, but my daughter and I both were too scared to keep watching.
Oh no, it's totally scary. But there is the Upside Down has what they must have just stolen from marine snow, because it looks exactly like it. So I find that interesting.
All right, I might have to steal myself and keep watching.
Or at least just peek at the scenes there, because it's for real scary. Pia's mom, Natalie, is a climate scientist who studies coral, and among many other things. And in a kind of unexpected move, she seems to me to be really the least anxious of all the novel's characters, even as she has...
a book full of anxious characters.
Yeah, it sure is.
It was such a generous introduction, and you kept mentioning people who have sort of unmanageable jobs. And I thought to myself, have I given everyone an unmanageable job? Because really, I was sort of amazed by the people who are doing the jobs that inspired the jobs in this novel. I really like to write about people at work. You know, I like to be able to see characters working in the book.
Teacher and doctor, I think are already kind of like overwhelming jobs, but you know, put in the accelerant of COVID, and they really are unmanageable. And maybe it's just that Natalie's a climate scientist, which is like just has a base level of anxiety that's so high that once you sort of acclimate to it, you don't seem as anxious. But I wonder if you saw her as anxious. I tended to think of her as just being able to like roll with things much more easily than Stephen or Pia.
Well, I think part of that is how far away she is. I knew I wanted her to be far away. And then I thought, you know, is that even possible today in the way that it was when, I first left home and was working in Bangkok. And, you know, every week or two, I would take a bus to go. But I went to this German bakery where they had this bright yellow international phone on the wall. And I'd call my parents and check in and tell them I was doing okay. But, you know, that's completely different now. We're attached by technology, and technology collapses distance. But I think it doesn't collapse it entirely. And she's, you know, it's hard to keep in touch with someone in another, even in another time zone, it's a bit harder. But when it feels like somebody in another world, I think it's communication becomes more attenuated. And Natalie's also doing this absorbing work. That's exactly what she wants to be doing. And I think that I write about scientists because their vocation seems similar to writing in certain ways. It's obsessive and it's normally not profitable and you never completely leave the office. And one of the scientists I became close to when I was on Morea, who's been so incredibly helpful to me, is an ecologist and a marine biologist named Susie Mills. And she struggles with, you know, wanting to be with her school age daughters and always and wanting them to have resources, educational resources that aren't always available where she's working. And I thought to myself, you know, I've made a really different choice. I'm a parent. I live here in Brooklyn in the city where I was born. My work doesn't so obviously depend on being somewhere else, but it does depend on kind of having new experiences. Like when I'm writing a book, I always need to be learning something, whether it's a language or a little bit of science, or like for this book, it was learning how to dive. It was, you know, I sort of knew that I had to be able to see what Natalie saw when she went down on a science dive. And so, you know, I took the classes so that I could do that.
Did you go down with the climate scientists when you were diving?
I just went. My certification is open water, which is the basic level. So I went down twice in Morea and I went in Belize. I had talked to a scientist early on in my research who described diving really early in the morning and going out over a wall. So, you know, where the ocean floor drops off and becomes much deeper. And that feeling of kind of being over the reef and then going out to where the reef has dropped off. And you feel, she says, you feel vertigo, you know, but you feel as if you're going to fall. Of course, it's not possible to fall, but you're just looking out into this blue. And I thought, wow, that, you know, that's something, an experience I would love to have, and which I probably won't have because I just don't, you know, I'm not going to have the skills. And on the first dive that I did for my certification, we were in a site that's exactly like that. And, you know, I was able to swim out, and sure enough, I mean, you have that your body is telling you that you're going to fall. It's just an incredible experience. I'd always wanted to learn. I hadn't had the opportunity. I was surprised by what I reacted to down there. I think, you know, I'd never thought much about sponges, but at the site where we were in Belize, there were these enormous, you know, 6 foot tall sponges, bright yellow or bright purple, and they look sort of like vases, like a standing vase you might find full of dried flowers or something. I was so moved by them. I mean, it sounds ridiculous, but there was a moment where I sort of started to cry underwater. Mm-hmm. I just thought there are these living things that are as different from us as possible that are down here, and you know, we aren't even aware of them. And that is true times 10 in the deep ocean, you know, because there are sponges there that can live to be 11,000 years old.
No.
Yeah. Yeah. That is the oldest living organism is an 11,000 year old sponge. And one of the most amazing things, one of the arguments against this kind of deep sea mining has been provided by scientists who have gone on these research missions and taken samples from sponges that turn out to be really valuable for the development of cancer drugs for immunotherapeutics because their biology is so foreign to ours. You know, we've developed in isolation for so many thousands of years that it's almost like finding an alien life form that has the potential to go into the, you know, to kind of go past the human immune system. You could synthesize. I'm going to probably butcher this because I'm not a biologist, but synthesize an enzyme based on these proteins and enzymes that you see in deep sea sponges that could be like a sort of secret messenger inside the human immune system because it's so different. So yeah. I read a paper about that completely blew me away. And Natalie mentioned something like that to Stephen, and they correspond in the novel through these emails, and she mentions that finding. So I think even when I'm like, you know, I'm studying something, I don't think that it's like the research is not the same as research that you would do for nonfiction, where you need to learn a certain amount of information before you can start writing. Like for me, it's kind of a process that I need to do all the way through the book, and some stuff makes it into the book and some doesn't, but it kind of is the energy that like powers the writing. And I think in a way, it's also how I like process the anxiety that comes along with like, should I be writing this? Like, do I know enough? Mm-hmm. So maybe Natalie's less anxious because she's working. Maybe that's the the very short answer I should have given instead of that long
one. If you had skipped that answer, I would have been very disappointed. I don't know if you, did you encounter the book Whale Fall last
year? I haven't read Whale Fall, but when I read the review, I bookmarked it. I definitely want to read that book. It sounds incredible.
Yeah, I'm not going to make a big argument for it as like high literature, but it is a totally absorbing novel. And I think what it does do really beautifully and well is talk about diving. And it's very clear that the author is either a very accomplished diver or did immense amount of work. And they talk about that kind of vertigo, and they talk about just sort of the coming off the wall and the kind of immense feeling of depth and vacuousness. And they describe undersea life like really quite well. And it's very fun. It's not giving anything away to say that the diver ends up inside a whale, and which is pretty amazing. So I recommend it. And I think you in particular will love it. So COVID is obviously one of the most visible limits in the novel. And you give us a window into, in particular, Stephen's experience of treating patients who die of that sort of early stage COVID, when it was so frightening because you could have a patient and it would appear that they were getting better or doing well, and their pulse ox was good, which you point out in the book. And then all of a sudden, just an absolute plummet in the health outcome, and they're intubated and then they're dead. And I wondered what led you to want to sort of capture and have a better sense of what this was like and have it be Stephen's job.
Yeah, I as weird as it sounds, I didn't really set out to write about COVID. It's just that I'm somebody who writes about contemporary life. I'm not a historical novelist. And so if a book that I wrote is being published in 2024, it's going to have COVID in it. And I think, but you know, the choice to have a physician, I definitely kind of went back and forth because I usually start with the person. And with Stephen, I started with a guy who was watching European men's soccer on TV and having too many drinks by himself in an apartment. And the reason he's a doctor is really because he's someone who comes from a privileged background and is talented and is a hard worker. And those facts have meant that he has never really come up against, he's not a bad guy, but he has never really come up against a situation that he couldn't control. And COVID is that situation. And he feels absolutely helpless for the first time in his life as an adult. I have a friend who, I know you're married to a physician, the way you said pulse ox. you have insight intel, but I just have one friend who is an infectious disease specialist, and she works at SUNY Downstate, which is a hospital in our neighborhood, and they always struggle. It's not a wealthy hospital. They struggle for resources. They struggled for PPE for sure during the pandemic. And she described to me coming home to her husband and kids and him asking about her day, and she said, you know, I did one useful thing today, and it was find a phone charger for a guy who was desperate to talk to his family. And I think it was that, you know, acknowledgement of helplessness in the face of a disease that you know, no one had any information about, that physicians were desperately talking to their colleagues in other countries and cities trying to figure out, you know, best practices for something that was totally unknown.
That's so true. And I want to just flag my colleague Jennifer Spitzer's article in the New York Times about having to say goodbye to her mother via text during the beginning months of the COVID outbreak, because it's an extraordinary just expression of grief and the unknown and how something like that technology that I'm sure a doctor helped her mother with was the only lifeline to communication during that time. So I'll just flag it for the audience and for you if you haven't read it.
When was that published?
It probably was a year ago now, but I'll link to it on the website, and I'll also link to your Nautilus article, because I'm sure listeners will be interested in that as well, and how you finagled your trip to Tahiti.
I don't know if you interviewed Waiki Wang when she wrote Joan Is Okay, but that's another novel that I love that deals with COVID and deals with these last conversations between family members.
Oh, I didn't know that. I've had that novel recommended to me many times, and I will definitely seek it out and put it on the website. So you're speaking of Tahiti, you're very interested in characters that cross national, geographic, and linguistic boundaries. And a lot of your fiction has focal characters that have moved or been moved out of a non-Western country and find themselves in places like the U.S. And in this case, while Pia is American, she's been living off the coast of Tahiti, speaking largely French with her mother and friends. Borders and boundaries are really powerful limits. What is it has been appealing to you across your works about having characters cross those limits?
So, well, I guess when I was younger, it was not having traveled far afield from where I was born, and until after college, spending time in Bangkok working, and then traveling around in India. And
what were you doing in Bangkok? Sorry to interrupt.
Oh, it was no problem. I was teaching English.
Okay, great.
Typical after college first job for an English major. I felt really lucky to get it. I was working at a high school, and also living on the campus of the high school. I had it was a strange apartment that was part of the campus, a huge high school. I can't remember. I think it had 5,000 students, sort of the size of Brooklyn Tech. My apartment had these tinted windows in the front that I guess were intended to keep out the bright sun. Had these really adorable students. Their uniforms looked like sailor outfits. For the girls had long pleated navy blue suits and one of those sailor collars. And they would, especially the girls, would come up to the tinted windows and put their hands by their eyes and to try to see in, like as if I was like a fish in a tank, like an interesting foreign fish. And I think all the stories in my first book took place elsewhere, because it was the first time that I had really had to think about being American. I mean, we're so isolated here. We're so monolingual. You can't drive across a border the way that Europeans do all the time. You don't automatically learn another language in school, or at least you don't usually become fluent in a second language in American elementary or high schools. And so, I thought that being in those places threw my Americanness into relief in a way that was fruitful for me with writing. And I think that the difference in this book is really came from, the sort of shift in what I wrote about for that article in Nautilus about, I was interested in the way that foreign scientists were, not at home in the place where they were doing their work, where, they were making absolute best efforts to, to do work that was more place-based, to listen to the people they were working around, to change the education system, which was a very colonial system that really kept people down by educating them in a language that wasn't their own, that actively suppressed the Tahitian language in favor of French, and with, predictable consequences for people's higher education. So at these labs, you don't find a lot of Tahitian scientists with PhDs, even though these islands have historically been full of scientists forever. The fisherman, the elderly Tahitian fisherman, arguably knows more about the reef and the ecology of the island than any scientist. But I was interested, just as a foreigner, in seeing my own experience as a writer, like the idea that maybe I do my best work in a place where I really don't, should I be there at all? And those ethical questions are interesting to me in this book.
Yeah, they are a fascinating part of Natalie being there and trying to understand her role. As any teacher or anyone with kids who were in school during the worst of the pandemic will tell you, hybrid was pretty bad, and remote schooling didn't do what we hoped it would. It seemed bad for learning and bad for social development and definitely bad for loneliness and isolation. You give us two very different versions of how that was experienced. There is Kate, who's living in a beautiful New York apartment, teaching online, while Pia is online at the Lycée school. And they have psychological burdens that are heavy, including the fact that Kate is pregnant. But meanwhile, Athena is taking her senior year online while fully taking care of her nephew, Marcus. You bring together these great inequities of contemporary life, economics and race, and put them in the pressure cooker of online school. Will you talk us through how you wanted those two things to collide?
Yeah. I mean, I think no novelist starts with great inequities. You always start with these very concrete situations. And so for me, it was that I've worked for a long time with Penn Writers in the Schools, which sends writers into New York City high schools to do what I do is mostly college essays. And I had always, you know, of course, been physically at school and with students. And then in 2020 and during some of 2021, I was on Zoom with students who were mostly at home. And sometimes it would be a student who had taken on a second job, you know, a job out during school hours, because that was now possible to help their family. Mm-hmm. But then lots of times, especially with young women, it would be childcare because daycares were closed, and if parents are essential workers, then, you know, someone's got to take care of the smaller children. And of course, a teenage girl gets tapped for that. And I think, you know, I remember working with one student on Zoom who had her camera off, and there was a lot of splashing. And I said, you know, are you doing, because we were working on her college essay, and I said, are you doing dishes? And she said, no, I'm giving the baby a bath, you know, her sister's baby or something. And I thought about how, you know, the first times I gave my own infants a bath, how slippery they are. What a difficult proposition.
The most slippery thing in the world, I would argue.
And, you know, and then there's another young woman who I became close with who had a nephew who was always appearing in our Zoom in a Spider-Man costume, sort of never took it off. And I remember one day talking to her, and she reached into the costume while we were speaking without breaking, you know, without a break in what we were talking about, and undid the pull-up, you know, those diapers that can be attached, detached on the sides, and took it off and magically, you know, put on another one. And I thought, that is something that I didn't learn to do until I was in my early 30s. And she's doing it here while she's writing an essay at the same time. And so I think it was just humbling for me to see not just kids who were caring for younger family members who were just providing the basic care, but kids who were caring for them, you know, with love and creativity in the way that I often failed to do when I was a mom at home with kids doing hybrid school in the kitchen. So I think I really started with the idea that I wanted to get that love into the book in some way, because it had moved me.
The amount of affection that I feel for Athena reading those scenes is, it's really a magnificent part of the novel. And I respect her as a character so much. And I see how you are sort of bringing your respect for those students into it. And it's really lovely. You know, a character who might have sort of fallen off our respect scale were she not handled with a great deal of nuance is Kate, who, you know, as someone who is not kind to his step-parents, apologies, I'm sending them out into the
ether. I'll send mine out with yours to my step-mother as well.
So for two people who were not kind to their step-parents when we were younger, you know, Kate has an enviable position of welcoming a teenager into her life with no context and having to figure out what her role is, how to maybe parent, maybe just try and keep, you know, catastrophes from happening. But we really end up rooting for Kate. And I wonder how she came into your imagination and what you did to make her a more nuanced kind of step-parent.
Yeah. I guess I had heard this story a few times of people who were quarantined with sort of new family members, or, you know, a relationship suddenly became more intimate than it otherwise would have been quickly because of the restrictions of quarantine. And I had always thought of Kate as someone who had a background of being like the bad kid in her family. She rebelled against her strict Catholic upbringing. And that's part of why she's a teacher, because she gets teenagers. But when the novel starts, she's just made a different kind of choice. She's married this wealthy surgeon in Manhattan, and she's pregnant. And there's a scene in the novel where her brother-in-law who's sort of like a charming cad, comes to visit them in Amagansett at this rundown house that the brothers share. And she kind of sees her husband and his brother together, and she thinks to herself, you know, I chose the right brother. I've changed. And, you know, maybe more than that, like, I've surprised the people who thought of me one way in my family. I've turned out to be a different way. But she also has this experience in her past that follows her, and it makes her pregnancy in the novel more fraught, especially because it takes place in quarantine with her stepdaughter, you know, who's becomes only more difficult as the novel progresses.
Yeah, that's she definitely does. I won't spoil anything, but it's worth reading the novel just to see where Pia's life goes in New York. One of the things that I really like about the novel is a change in narrative voice and perspective that happens with Pia, where we get, you know, move from a third person to a first person in Pia's section. And part of what's happening in that section is a kind of a chance for Pia to flesh out or even flush out anxieties that she has. And she has this love interest, Rafi, who's pretty inappropriate for her in a lot of ways, but he has lost his father to the poisoning of the land on the island by nuclear testing. And I wonder how that intentional poisoning of the land parallels humans' longer sort of historical destruction of the environment. And also, I'm really interested why you decided to have Pia get that first person voice.
Yeah, I mean, I started out, I wasn't going to write from Pia's point of view. It was the other characters. I started early with Athena and Kate and Natalie and Stephen. And I thought Pia was just she's a bit of a mess. She's furious at both of her parents, doesn't know where she wants to be. But at the same time, her privilege doesn't give her any excuses. She's not being asked to do much. She should behave and she should get good grades. But, you know, one of the things that I love about working with teenagers is that they are absolutely expert at sniffing out hypocrisy. You cannot make a blunder, you know. They'll call you out for microaggressions. They'll call you out for calling, which, you know, is appropriate. And then they'll also call you out for referring to weed as pot. I once did that in school and the entire class burst into laughter.
Are we not allowed to do that now?
It's not called pot anymore. That's just very, you're just very old. It's like saying that you were in the New Yorkers 20 under 40 in 2010. You know, it really dates you.
No, 2010 was like 2 years ago. Let's just make that very clear.
That's absolutely right. So Pia is, you know, I think she's appropriately skeptical about a lot of things. Like she's skeptical of her mother's work and its relationship to colonialism in French Polynesia, and her stepmother's work and its relationship to income inequality in New York City. And her voice, once I hit on the idea of a journal, and especially you were saying, you know, editorializing in the journal, but in a way it was like the compression of the way she writes, which is sometimes like in text message style and sometimes it's simply lists of nuclear tests and dates that she's gotten off Wikipedia or whatever.
And also, text message style, but almost like, you know, a play dialogue as well.
Well, she's a kid who's been happiest when she's been allowed to be on stage. She's always put on costumes and, you know, the pandemic kind of shutters the idea of school theater, which was one of the only things she was looking forward to coming back to school in New York City for. And so she sometimes writes in dialogue, which is also like one of my greatest pleasures of writing. I like writing dialogue more than anything else. And so it was like the sort of being able to juxtapose these different styles in her journal, almost like in a kind of like grab bag poetry Dada kind of way. It was a way for her to point out these like these disjunctions that she's seeing, these things that are frustrating her about the way that her parents see the world.
So before I let you go, I'd love to know a little bit about what you've been reading and loving recently, and whether you have any recommendations for the listeners.
I have lots of recommendations. I have, so in terms of stuff that I've been reading, Kairos is my favorite book that I've read in the last year.
That was recommended by another guest, and it's a German novel, right?
It's Jenny Erpenbeck novel about a young woman in East Germany who falls in love with this much older writer, journalist, and their relationship. And the way that it maps onto the political situation as the wall is about to come down, and the way that it doesn't. I mean, it's a book that just absolutely frustrates your idea to make the characters particular, give the characters particular political meanings. So I always recommend that book. I love Tessa Hadley's stories After the Funeral that I just read. I always loved Tessa Hadley. And then I read the last book by Magda Szabo that I hadn't read was The Fawn. And so that's about a Hungarian actress whose fortunes changed dramatically after World War II in Budapest.
I don't know that author.
Oh, so she wrote The Door.
The Door, yes. The Door.
Yeah. I love all of her novels. So that one, you did a great episode with Percival Everett, and I had just read The Trees while I listened to it. And so that novel is funny and brutal, and I'm really eager to read James.
I am too. I can't wait. I mean, I have a lot of books to read for interviews, and I can't wait for a little pause in that, because James is number one on my list from there.
Yeah. And then I should also say that, so through one of the wonderful things about the research for this book was that I met the translator of Tahitian author Tetuawa Pu. I'm worried that I'm mispronouncing her last name. She's the author of Mutisms and also Peanut, and her translator is Jeffrey Zuckerman, and we've become really good friends since we met through through this author. So I have a whole list of books that were really inspiring to me when I was working on this book that I would love to, if there's a way to link that list for anyone who's interested in Tahitian fiction, poetry, or in marine scholarship, because there are a couple of really great books that have come out recently about the deep ocean. There's one called The Brilliant Abyss by Helen Scales. And then there's a great book called Below the Edge of Darkness by Edith Witter that's about a scientist who has this accident early in her life that threatens to blind her. She doesn't actually become blind, but after she recovers, she gets really interested in bioluminescence in the deep ocean and, you know, light in the depths of the ocean. And so there's a book about that. And then, you know, also poetry. There's a poet who's mentioned in the novel, Kathy Danielle Kitchener. And I would just encourage anyone who's interested to listen to her address to the UN. I think it's 2014. She's a Marshallese poet, and she writes about the devastation of American nuclear tests on her archipelago of islands. Incredibly moving. If you're up for that, I would love to link. Yeah. There's a whole bunch of books related to Tahiti and marine science.
I think if I didn't at this point, the audience would be pretty mad. So I'd love to link to that, and I'd love to learn more about an area of the world that I know so little about. And I'm so glad that it called to you. And I want to very much recommend The Limits, the latest by Nell Freudenberger, truly a wonderful novel from its gorgeous story and characterizations, but also in its unpacking and unveiling so many things about the world that might escape our notice and shouldn't. Nell, it was such a pleasure to get to talk with you. I've been a fan of your work since the story Lucky Girls was in that debut fiction just 2 years ago in 2010.
2001. That was 3 years ago.
Yes, right. 3 years ago. And thank you so much for coming on and talking to me.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, that's all from me for now. My thanks to the brilliant Nell Freudenberger for coming on to talk about her latest novel, The Limits. You can find links to purchase The Limits and all of Nell's recommended books at the website, burnedbybooks.com. You'll note that Nell has provided a special list of Tahitian literature as a starter for those interested in an underrepresented postcolonial literature. As well, you'll find links to Nell's article about her time on Morea in Nautilus magazine, and to my colleague Jennifer Spitzer's essay on losing her mother at the height of COVID that was published in the New York Times. Please do head to the website to find all of our previous episodes, links to buy a podcast t-shirt, and ways to get in contact. As you listen, take a moment to rate the show on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you find your podcasts. Until next time, this has been Burned by Books.